Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Haudenosaunee poet Kenzie Allen about her debut collection, Cloud Missives, one that explores pop culture, the stereotypes in Peter Pan and Indiana Jones, for instance, fairy tales, myths, protests, and forgotten histories. The collection ends with a series of love poems that aim to deepen our understanding of romantic, platonic, and communal love. This conversation was coordinated in partnership with the Headwaters Reading Series for Health and Well-Being, elevating underrepresented voices and inspiring learning and conversation on important yet often overlooked health issues, including Native American well-being, mental health, and disability. Kenzie, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you so much for having me. Saguli Swagweg. Hello to all of you. And Yuanko, thank you.
I'm just going to dive in. I hope that's okay. The poems in this collection, your debut collection, Cloud Missives, see you, or we'll probably talk about this, the speaker, as a self in relationship to history and community. Tell me about how poetry, and perhaps more specifically your poetry, allows you to bridge your individual and your communal and your historical selves.
Well, I see poetry as kind of working twofold. You, of course, have something in you that you're writing to explore, or questions that you're writing to excavate or investigate. But you also have an audience, particularly with poetry that you intend to publish, and more so audiences, right? You have more than one audience. And so I think a lot about writing toward maybe helping to bring people into a certain world of Haudenosaunee cosmologies. I think about speaking to other Haudenosaunee people or Indigenous peoples. And I think about speaking to others who might be looking for their sense of self and be able to find it through what they read, not just my work, but the work of poetry in general. So I see poetry as a method, if you will.
I was just going to ask, is poetry for you a demonstration of process or of this excavation, as you call it, or discovery?
Oh, absolutely. I see poetry as storytelling, and I also have worked in anthropology and archaeology, and I see those as extensions of storytelling as well. You have your kind of evidences in the world, and then you are working to make sense of them, to juxtapose them, and to learn from the ways that they echo against each other and with each other.
I want to come back to storytelling and excavation, archaeology, anthropology a little bit later, because I feel like that is ripe for conversation. I want to talk first about time and the way that you've both conceived of it in this collection and how, to my reading, it has benefited the writing of this collection. The poems collected here, as I understand it, they've spanned a decade's worth of writing. So I imagine that the self that began writing these poems is not the self that you are today publishing this collection. And then there is a self that oscillates between the past, the present, and then future histories, also between a body that experiences violence and then repair, violence and then recovery. I'm wondering, do those ideas resonate with you as they relate to time?
Absolutely. For one, there's a sort of chronology that's happening in the book, or a narrative arc even that's made through that process that you mentioned about the poems having been written over a decade. Some of the poems were written in 2011, and some of the poems were written just last year. And I do see a kind of movement from confronting violences and confronting hurts into the processing of those things, processing of identity, and then eventually sort of more moving toward connections with the world around you, which I think is the same journey that the speaker goes through. And then there's also multiple senses of time between the body, which holds the time and the memories of our life and histories. The body is sort of a record of all the things that may have happened to us or all of our favorite ways. And then when you go through trauma, time becomes a very slippery thing. You go through flashbacks and you do imagine what's going to happen to me in the future, or you try to imagine it. In forensic anthropology, when you're working with bones and an actual individual skeleton, you may be thinking about what's going to happen to your bones one day. And so there's that sort of layering or palimpsestic sort of relationship that's happening there. And then I think about indigenous notions of time and time as cyclical, time as thinking about the seventh generation, so seven generations back that you learn from and you plan for seven generations in the future. And your relationship with your ancestors is very much part of your present as well. So someone could have walked on 1,000 years ago or last year, and they are still your relatives. You still honor them and you still want to take care of them and sort of let them influence you. So I think time is a very malleable thing, and I think it's a very affecting thing for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about how that seven generations forward and backwards affects your movement in time, your decision-making in the present. You sort of answered that. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think, like, going back to talking about the kind of processing of identity, at first it was sort of processing the colonial violences that were happening in the world. And I sort of felt like, I mean, 10 years ago, the conversation around indigeneity was very different.
Sure.
It's moved forward in some really good ways. We're still stuck in some other ways. But at the time, I really felt like I had to speak toward what I'll call shared reference points. But oftentimes that was stereotypes or the Hollywood Indian, if you will, in order to move toward lived experience. And then as I went along and as that that public conversation shifted, I felt like I was able to start speaking directly to lived experience from the get-go in a poem. And then I started thinking about futurisms, and I thought about the Oneida core values like Galiwiyo, which is to speak with good words about ourselves, our nation, and our future. And I think about what to leave our youth with and our peoples with in terms of imagining a good future for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of questions that might be wrapped up in some of the ideas and themes that you were just talking about. But first, I would love it if you read a poem from this collection. Kenzie, will you read How to Be a Real Indian?
Yes.
And to our listeners, I'll just say that in focusing on this poem, we're jumping into the second section of this collection.
Yes, this comes from the Manifest section, which is a play on manifest destiny, but also on manifesting the self. So this is How to Be a Real Indian. The first time someone asks you how Indian you are, lie. On the blacktop, the soccer field, tell them 100% your grandmother lived on the res, or you were born there, hooked up to machines running on bad generators, in a bad hospital, in a bad part of town. Say you dream in Oneida at night. Show and tell them Rose Rock and Kachina. Give them exactly what they ask for the first time. Learn to read from that book of the boy who falls in love with Minnehaha, invents written language, discovers corn, and departs in a canoe. In the third grade, when your class suggests 10 little Indians for the Thanksgiving theme, offer to teach them the dances you don't know but should. Swallow hard. Imagine your ancestors, the ones you see each day when you get home from school, staring down at you from the walls of your grandmother's house, draped in their turbans and regalia. Tecumseh, Red Cloud, imagine their eyes, not sad, but fascinated by the evenness of your buckskin fringe, the wild neon in your store-bought feathers. Sing 10 Little Indians. Fan your hand across your mouth. Say, how? The second time someone asks how Indian you are, embellish. If you find out your mother's mother's father was the son of a chief, tell them your mother was a princess. Tell them your mother sang you songs at night while rocking the cradle in her native tongue, but she's forgotten all of it now. Tell them your tribe waits for you, wants to embrace you as one of their own. Tell them you are loved by your tribe. Memorize the names of the Six Nations. After all, there is an agency for everything. Call the BIA. Aren't you on the list? And at first, this is a wonderful game. Metoxins and Doc Staters, Hills and the occasional Cornelius. No Antones in sight. No compound noun names. When you find the man who might have cradled your mother's mother's small head in his hands, you must sniff out the whole line. Begat and begat and begat. Married, then divorced, then they split up the property and moved to Oklahoma. All the people who passed down the blood you wanted to be rid of, sometimes, the blood you wished could multiply. Give them names. Tally up their fractions. The third time you are asked how Indian you are, decide it doesn't matter exactly. Say an eighth. Say a 32nd. Claim to be Choctaw or Cherokee. Claim to be a princess, too. Talk about quantum as though trying to find a way to name yourself. Go back to the res. Brenda's gotten clearance to open up a bar just in time for your coming of age. Take your white boyfriend and play pool with him amid a cloud of smoke, where he will chat up the locals, where he will talk about enterprise and fair trade. At the powwow, buy turquoise and the tail of a fox and soft white cowskin for your mother's moccasins. Eat fry bread every day of your life if you can. On the way home, a Chickasaw will sit down next to you on the plane with his hair in two black braids and cowrie shells around his leathery neck. Despite eagerness, opportunity, the sudden, improbable phenomenon of two live Indians on the same plane together at the same time, say nothing. If he says something first, stay quiet. Because you aren't just two live Indians on the same plane together at the same time. You're one Indian and a fraud flying toward Delaware. The fourth time, the fifth time, the eighth time they ask you how Indian you are. Your mouth is so, so heavy. Let it hang open for a moment so the spirits can enter. Let the woman who had your name and died before you were born come into your body and speak the wisdom. Let her grandmother willow you. Let your head hang over the stump of Chief Powhatan, ready to be bludgeoned by your own father for love. Take Maria Tallchief into your limbs, eagle graceful, turtle strong. Try to imagine your own face on the face of a gold coin the baby on your back, as recognizable as the way you point the way and shut that open mouth. Make its flatness stretch towards centuries of silence. Lead the men down the great river to whatever they seek.
You're such a great reader. There are so many lines I want to point to from that poem, but the first one, your mother sang you songs at night while rocking the cradle. There's an entire section of this collection, the last section, devoted to love songs. But songs appear in other sections and other poems of the book as well. So I'm wondering, Kenzie, about the relationship to song and its role in these poems in this collection.
I'm so happy that you asked about this because music has been such a part of my life. My grandmother raised me to sing. She taught me to sing. Every night we would go to the piano and she would say, let's make some music. And my Oneida name, which I received when I was a little bit older, is Yagot Lenodad, which means she plays music as she goes along. And the going along is a continual tense. All of our names, all of our language in Oneida is very verb-based. So there's always movement sort of intrinsic in the language. But I learned to sing opera as well. And so there's a little bit of reference to opera in here. There's La Traviata.
Cadenza, right?
Yeah, cadenzas.
Yeah.
La Boheme's in there as well. And then there's also just the sort of music of the world around you. I do think of the earth and its movements as very musical. But there's singing till our lungs give out, the sort of way that the breath lives in the body for poetry is also the way that the body is the instrument in music.
Absolutely. And our listeners will have just heard you read this extraordinary poem. It's so obvious that the reading of the poem is just as important as the writing and the publishing of the poem, too.
The words live in the breath, and the breath lives in the air. And I also think about that when I speak Oneida language. I'm still learning the language, very much still a beginner, but every time you put the language into the air, it's very important, and it sort of lets the language live in community that way.
You're listening to A Conversation with Kenzie Allen. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com.
I love what you also said about the Oneida language being a moving tense. It's in motion, a verb tense. That speaks to what we were talking about, time, and this idea of looking forward.
Yeah, all of our names are that way too. And the way that we think of, you know, you can learn a lot from the language. You can learn about how to be in the world. You can learn from sort of even scientific principles that are built into different words. What I'm thinking right now is actually the Ojibwe word for like good day is good rotation. So the so there's kind of things you can learn from Oneida language, and you really can't learn of a culture until you learn at least what you can of the language as well.
Mm-hmm. What has the process been like for you learning the Oneida language?
Well, it's a little bit difficult because I will say that for the Wisconsin Oneidas, I think we have something like 30 first language speakers at this time. There is a huge effort to revitalize the language, and we think about that. Even the term revitalization is very important rather than preservation, because if language lives in community, then preserving it and simply recording it isn't enough. But it's good that we do have those recordings. Mm-hmm. There is a wonderful dictionary that was written by partially by Maria Hinton, Yageyale, she remembers, who is also the woman who gave me my name. And she used to keep all of the names in a plastic box, like in an index card box organized by clan. And there are a few more resources that are available outside of the, you know, there's on the reservation community, there are resources available. And then there's a few more resources available outside, like our mobile app, actually, which mm-hmm. anyone can download from the App Store. And that has even Maria's voice some of the time. So even though Maria has walked on, I'm able to listen to her voice through that app. It's very meaningful. But you just kind of keep practicing. And I think it's important to consider the composition of words and to kind of play with the phonemes a little bit and create your own words as well as a means of learning the language, to engage with it both very seriously and also playfully, mm-hmm. To just like really enjoy and appreciate the language.
And enter poetry in that very real way.
Absolutely. I think most of these languages are very poetic. They are composed, like words can be composed of so many different ideas within their syllables in this language. And since it is verb-based, you do have to think about like what you're moving toward and what the word is moving toward. And I think that's something that poetry does too. I think poetry involves that kind of forward momentum, or at least I think a lot about momentum when I'm writing.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like your philosophy of poetry is very much in line with the Oneida philosophy of moving forward.
I try to do that now. I think it took some time for me to learn that. Mm. And it did take also continuing to kind of integrate back into my reservations community. My family grew up away from our reservation, partially because of just trying to find work and following your partners throughout the world, but also after two generations of our family attended the Carlisle Indian Industrial Boarding School.
Wow.
And were sort of subject to that assimilation pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a long journey, both away and then back to the reservation. And learning from that community has been the most important thing in my life and remains the most important thing in my life. And figuring out how to have that be a reciprocal relationship so that you're not just taking the knowledge away from the community, the same way that you ask linguists not to take that knowledge away from the community, but to keep feeding back into community and develop that reciprocal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important when people are writing about cultures that have experienced colonization. Is to think about forging reciprocal relationships so that people can also say, no, don't do that, and you listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think very carefully and about ethics in poetry and how I'm telling this story. I think about always having Oneida people in the audience at the same time that I'm writing. And the more that I learn, the more that I try to gear toward those Oneida core values.
Yeah. Let's pivot. Kenzie, will you read another poem, Determination of Racial Affinity?
Yes, and I'll preface this by saying this comes from studies of forensic anthropology, and this was one of the poems that was written 10 years ago, so that conversation has moved forward a little bit, but I think that there is still this influence of colonial origins to these sciences. So Determination of Racial Affinity has an epigraph that comes from an imagined textbook entry, but it's certainly based on some of the principles that were being taught in forensic anthropology at the time. So the epigraph reads, "Oftentimes, a skeleton exhibits characteristics of more than one racial group and does not fit neatly into the three-race model." This is Determination of Racial Affinity. A shapely nasal spline, rounded maxilla, and that flick of a scalloped incisor. In all likelihood, according to the chart on the wall, we can't be certain when only bone remains, but compare ulnar length, mandibular jut, these caveats of origin. I press my tongue to my teeth and find no curved hollow. I press my hands to my mouth and find no fuller jaw. The teeth on the table stay quiet, the zygomatic arch gentle and inconclusive. All I know, her hands are smaller than mine. Are the cheekbones prominent? Is there facial prognathism? What is the shape of the cranial vault? Asiatic, Caucasoid, Congoid. Alternate morphs for sunsoak, overcast, sweet tilt of the sockets, the way draw girls around the world explained ethnic realism. Make her lips large and full. Give her beautiful hips and tiny shoulders. Define her muscle thus. They don't say it starts in the skeleton, in fragments of fragments, and the 0.002 gram that could be user error or could mean your ancestors carried you down the river in the cradle board of everything. Nothing mentions variability. And how every time you look at that skull of hers, it changes. How you can't pull off your own skin and ask your body questions.
How you can't pull off your own skin and ask your body questions. I'm curious, Kenzie, I think, about how you physically feel desire to use your own body as a resource for information and history. I want to know how that desire manifests in your body. How do you satisfy that yearning?
When I was studying forensic anthropology and archaeology, you learned so much about how people's morphology and animals' morphology, too, changes to meet the circumstances of the life. There's a lot of that in this book, and it's all true. The bones thicken like pearls because of lifting a child, for example. The way that the ankle is twisted, I say in the book, can betray a man bent in the mines. So the different patterns that your body goes through affects even your bones. But there's also things that don't affect your bones in that same direct way. There's things like depression and anxiety. There's things like hurts that you've experienced spiritually and mentally.
So that was Haudenosaunee poet Kenzie Allen, author of Cloud Missives, out now from Tin House Books. This conversation was coordinated in partnership with the Headwaters Reading Series for Health and Well-Being. To listen to this conversation again or to share it with friends, go to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.